the governor threatens a veto. Holcomb's still dropping all statewide COVID restrictions, plus no cigarette tax hike, and more on Indiana Week in Review for the week ending April 2nd, 2021.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller. Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.
This week, Governor Eric Holcomb said he will veto legislation that allows lawmakers to call themselves into special session during a public emergency. Many lawmakers are angry over some of the executive orders issued by Holcomb during the pandemic. And while earlier versions of legislation this session would have severely restricted the governor's emergency powers, the latest allows legislators to call a special session during an emergency. It gives themselves, lawmakers say, a voice in the process. Holcomb, in an opinion supported by legal experts, says the Indiana Constitution only allows the governor to call a special session.
I cannot skirt my duty and do something that I believe is unconstitutional. So to be as clear as your question is with my answer, yes, I could answer that in four letters, and it's V-E-T-O.
Holcomb notes he repeatedly asked legislative leaders during the pandemic if they wanted a special session, and they said no. Are lawmakers and the governor headed for a court battle? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat, Ann Delaney. Republican, Mike O'Brien. John Schwanis, host of Indiana Lawmakers. And Nikki Kelly, State House reporter for the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting State House reporter Brandon Smith. Mike O'Brien, how does this all look to Hoosiers?
Well, I think the legislature, in reacting this way, are clearly pointed at things like the mask mandate and the things that are like front and center in people's minds, people who are frustrated with a year long of COVID protections and lockdowns and all of this. Legislators, they're reflecting that. I mean, they're going home and they're if you get outside of central Indiana or outside Marion County, the compliance with these things is much lower and the frustration is much higher. But that's also why, so the legislature reacts to that, but that's also why we have a legislature, because they can react to the moment in time that their constituents have an opinion on all these things. But we have a governor who can take the long view on all this, who can look at things holistically, who's not just thinking about one part of the state or the other, but can think about the entire state, what's good for the entire state. I think the most concerning issue in this, with this mountain of money that the federal government has given, that is just raining down on all states, is now the legislature wants some control over that. We have benefited Indiana greatly, I believe, having a constitutionally weak governor, but for his ability to move money around, to change spending priorities. The budget that comes through the legislature is largely a recommendation on how to spend money. But when times are, you know, because you can't predict what's going to happen in a two-year period. You know, when they passed the budget in 2007, they couldn't predict a global financial meltdown in 2008, but Mitch Daniels had the power to augment the budget and control that. The legislature inserting itself into that part of the process now and determining where money is spent specifically in state government, I think is a real problem, because the last three governors have been good at managing in that moment when the circumstances change. And that's the point, when the legislature shouldn't come back in as a slow-moving branch of government and react to something that needs to be figured out today.
Annalyn, I know you're not a fan of what the legislature has been trying to do this whole session in terms of changing the emergency powers or affecting them in any way. But if you're an average person who's looking at what's going on now, the governor saying, nope, I'm going to veto this, legislators saying, we're going to override that veto, it potentially going to court, do you just look at it all and say, well, this is just the system being broken all over again?
Well, there's a certain element of truth to that, okay? I mean, what you have here are the Republican Party controlled by the No Science Flat Earth Society, and that's what these people are. You can say what you want about the compliance. The data shows that if you wear the mask, it slows the spread of COVID. And we have to do that. It's rising again in large part because people are not following those guidelines and getting vaccinated and doing what they're supposed to do. Okay, I mean, if these people want to die, it's their choice, okay? It's their choice. But the idea that the legislature is going to be able to step in and it's clearly, it's not even constitutional. I mean, don't they read the Constitution?
They have and think they have a path forward on constitutionality.
Yeah, well, they're nuts, okay? And, you know, I know there aren't a lot of practicing lawyers in the Republican caucus, but there are a couple. And
one
they
of
ought
whom
to be,
is the head of the Senate.
And they ought to be out there saying that this is not constitutional and we shouldn't try it because you're wasting finite state resources. However this is going to go, however the suit's going to be brought, we're going to litigate this when we shouldn't because this is not the right approach.
Nikki, I want to bring up something Mike just talked about, which is the financial portion of this bill, which we haven't talked on this show a lot about. But I think I was the one who brought it up to Representative Houston or Senator Bray this week. If that's important, why not actually give yourselves a little more power on how to spend that money? Because
yeah,
it doesn't, right?
It's funny because, you know, technically they should be appropriating by law every penny that's spent in the state. And that didn't happen with the $3 billion last year at all. And this bill to be, I mean, no offense, doesn't do much. It just says...
If they're in session,
if they're in session, they have to appropriate. But if they're not in session, all it says is it has to be reviewed by the State Budget Committee. That's a non-binding, just, here's what we're going to do with it. It's not real approval or anything. So
they could write that into... There are some things that have to be approved.
But they're not going that way. And on the constitutionality part, I just want to point out that their best argument is... It doesn't say we can't. That's their argument.
I used to try that with my parents. It didn't quite work out. John, I want to ask about the idea of calling themselves into special session because they need a voice in this process. That's a perfectly valid opinion. However, is it undercut at all by the fact that, as Governor Holcomb has repeatedly pointed out, he asked legislative leaders repeatedly, do you need to come back to special session? And they kept saying no. Does that undercut the argument at all?
I think it does call into question the sincerity, perhaps, because if he is right, and I don't know if we've ever heard the phone call, the recordings of the phone calls where he said, do you want to come back?
Well, but
do you
Todd Houston back? This week said yes. He asked us, and yes, we said no.
Well, yes, then it does undercut. Because, again, if you're the governor and you have exercised this power that you have, this emergency power, and then you say, but 150 of my dear friends, do you want to come in and weigh in on this? And they say no. It's kind of hard then for those individuals to raise a stink after the fact, so to speak, that they weren't consulted. It's going to be
messy.
It is messy, and you see Republican leadership walking a fine line. On the one hand, they are answering, especially those who represent rural constituencies, to folks who say, I want to wear a mask. This is all kind of silly. The scientists cook this up. But you also have Republican leadership not wanting to necessarily take on the governor or say disparaging things about the governor, which is why you had either, I can't remember if it was Bray or Houston this week, who went out of his way to say, you know, the governor has done a really real, I think it was three or four reallys, maybe four or five really, 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 really good job. And so it's almost this, I'm so sorry I'm having to do this, but I gotta take care of this constituency over here. It puts them in an interesting spot.
All right. Well, Governor Eric Holcomb is still dumping all statewide COVID-19 restrictions next week, even as his top state health official warns of worsening spread.
COVID-19 cases, hospitalizations, positivity rate, and county-based risk of spread have all been going in the wrong direction in recent days or weeks. And State Health Commissioner Dr. Chris Box says the state has identified the UK, Brazil, South Africa, and California variants of the virus in Indiana.
We cannot throw caution to the wind and behave as if the pandemic is over.
Holcomb says he's confident the state has the capacity to care for those who need the hospital if they get infected with COVID-19.
There's some personal responsibility that will be demanded if we want to continue to manage our way through this.
In a statement, the Indiana Democratic Party says Holcomb is acting irresponsibly, risking the state's progress for political, not scientific reasons.
And Delaney, on April 6th, there will be no more statewide COVID-19 restrictions. Will we ever see any more statewide COVID-19 restrictions?
Well, I think it depends. I mean, we're on a rush to get herd immunity. We're somewhere around 40% inoculated. We have to get much further along than that in order to get the herd immunity. And if we have another spike, it seems that the variants of this virus are wreaking havoc in Europe. I mean, France is on shutdown. Italy's on complete shutdown. So I think it's potentially possible. The numbers are going in the wrong direction. I think he was premature to do this, and it was from political pressure, not from any sense of the health issues involved here. So I think it's possible. I hope it isn't. I hope enough people have enough sense to get the vaccine and we can get the herd immunity and shut this down, but I'm not as confident as I could be.
Dr. Box said this week that we are in a race between vaccinations versus these variants, and right now the variants are picking up steam. The governor has said from day one of this pandemic, the data drives his decisions. How do you look at all those numbers and say the data drives the decision to end all statewide restrictions?
I think it's what he said in the lead-up in his press conference where he talked about hospital capacity and that issue. I think if we get slammed again, and the measuring stick originally was on how long to lock down and when to ease, the thought was if there are people out there who are getting sick that cannot get access to the care they need and would have otherwise survived, then we have to put these measures in place to manage that capacity and create, you know, preserve that capacity, shut down elective procedures, all the things that happened. So the governor's mind is still clearly on the science and the health metrics. So if we get to that max point again where there's just not access to the healthcare system for people that need it, then maybe we do start rolling some of these back in. But I think it's clear that they're still focused on the metrics here.
Is it realistic to expect that we will ever see any more statewide COVID-19 restrictions?
Well, keep in mind that this is all unfolding with the backdrop of the issue we just discussed with the first topic. So, I mean, it's not as if the governor's actions, regardless of which path he takes, won't be questioned in an even higher, an even brighter spotlight by members of the General Assembly and by the public and by the press because of this dispute that has been set up. So it really puts him in a bit of an awkward position. I think probably in hindsight, he wishes he had a mulligan on a couple of these instances he seems to have gotten into trouble. And he's done, I think, arguably both sides would say, a very good job throughout this process. But by attaching specific dates, target dates for the end of all of these emergency measures, twice it's really come back to bite him. The first one was July 4th, Independence Day, of last year. And that obviously didn't come to pass.
Yeah, then we started saying 4.5,
right.
4.75.
Right, and he probably wishes he hadn't. And now he probably wishes he had not said April 6th. I'm guessing there was some calculation in terms of doing it while the General Assembly was still in session, maybe. I know the metrics are the metrics, but maybe there's also some political gain to say it's coming off. You don't need to take any drastic actions to curb my authority because, as you can see, I'm a reasonable person and I'm dialing this back.
Yeah.
And he probably wishes he hadn't put a date on either of those instances.
If you listen to Eric Holcomb, he's repeatedly rejected the notion that the legislature is influencing his decisions at all. But there are some resolutions on the House and Senate in the House and Senate Republican caucuses that keep adding more and more co-sponsors that would stop everything right the second they voted for it. So that's got to play a role, right?
It has to, because it would stop a lot more than just masks. If they ended that emergency, it would stop a whole host of things that are helping people and that they don't necessarily disagree with, but there's no way to pick and choose, really. We like this part of your order and not this part of your order kind of thing. So it is definitely impacting his decision. I will say one thing, and I agree, the only time I would think we'd see it again is if we fall back to what we saw kind of at the end of last year. I mean, when hospitals were turning people away from ERs and couldn't treat them, say if you fell off your roof putting up your Christmas lights or, you know, nothing to do with COVID, that puts all Hoosiers in danger, not just the ones who aren't vaccinated for COVID.
And well, God willing, with vaccinations picking up steam, hopefully we will never get into that sort of situation again. Let's keep our fingers crossed. Time now for viewer feedback. Each week, we pose an unscientific online poll question in conjunction with our Ice Miller email and text alerts. This week's question, will Governor Holcomb ever reimpose any statewide COVID-19 restrictions? A yes or B no. Last week, we asked you if April 6th is the right time to end all of those statewide COVID-19 restrictions. Just 25% say yes, 75% of you say no. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to wfyi.org/IWIR and look for the poll. Well, Senate Republicans will not include an increase in the state's cigarette tax in their budget proposal. Senate President Pro Tem Roderick Bray announced that this week.
Advocacy groups, everyone from the Indiana Hospital Association and State Medical Association to the Indiana Chamber of Commerce, have argued for years that the state needs to reduce the number of Hoosiers who smoke. And study after study shows that raising the cigarette tax by at least a dollar per pack can do that. The House Republican budget included a 50-cent hike, but Senate President Pro Tem Roderick Bray says his caucus isn't prepared to do even that.
Obviously, it's a very, very regressive tax. And so we want to be cognizant of that.
Bray says the Senate GOP budget will likely impose a new tax on e-cigarettes, which he says brings them into parity with traditional cigarettes.
Nikki Kelly, are you surprised by this?
I don't think too much. He had definitely indicated that there were problems within his caucus, you know, in the last month or so. I am interested in the fact that, though, that, you know, we talk a lot about doing things to improve the health of Hoosiers, and we hear that from Republicans. But here's one thing that statistically for decades works in reducing a major health indicator, and they just won't do it. And at the same time, we also lag in cessation money that goes to helping. So,
this would also help.
Yeah, exactly. So in that situation, I am a little surprised that there's just something about that tax increase that they just can't get over the hump about it.
If they can't get support in the Senate Republican caucus to increase the cigarette tax, coming off of a year in which Indiana was hit harder by a virus because in part of its high smoking rates, will they ever have support in that caucus?
It does make you wonder. You know, Grover Norquist, head of the tax pledge architect, who seems to hold sway over a lot of people across the country, you would think he's a member of the caucus, the way that everybody marches in lockstep. Not everybody. Certain members march in lockstep.
There's clearly enough of them.
There is no tax increase that is acceptable to some members, and enough members apparently that leadership decided it's not worth it. Now, in the form that came over from the House, one would question, you know, how much of an impact it would have anyway. Had been reduced to 50 cents, down from a dollar. A lot of advocates had been calling for a $2 pack increase,
studies say you start to change behavior at about the dollar per pack.
Right, fact, some supporters had said 50 cents isn't even worth it, so don't bother. So there's sort of some political cover there. And then there was also the debate about the money go to cessation programs. Actually, under, I think, the House plan, it would have gone to Medicaid funding for the state's portion of Medicaid, so as opposed to direct smoking cessation programs. So, you know, does its removal have a lot of an impact beyond symbolism? Probably not.
Same question. Is this ever going to get through?
I don't know. I think what bothers me about the no tax increase ever pledge is that it's not Republican and it's not conservative. If you're a Republican or a conservative Republican, use the tax code to incentivize behavior you like and disincentivize behavior you don't like. So pick conservative things that you want to incentivize and have the tax code, you know, make it read like we wrote it on purpose. The cigarette tax is a perfect example. If we want people, I think there is a lack of trust in the health data that a higher tax has that big of an impact on smoking. I do think this is cultural in Indiana. I do think it's going to be a generational, but it's only going to improve if we invest in public health and health education in the schools right now, so the next generation understands how to stay healthy.
Well, because the other thing here is with what we've seen from a cigarette tax increase in other states is, it lowers the smoking rate, which means you have to spend less on health because people's health generally improves.
Yeah.
But what isn't breaking through?
It's the tax notion. It is. They're not true conservatives. They are Donald Trump advocates, is what they are. And no tax is ever acceptable. And they don't want to see the data.
This hesitance has existed long before Donald Trump became the Republican
nominee.
Well, it
may be, but it's the same kind of Tea Party approach that did come before Donald Trump, and that's what started this whole thing going. And what happens here is that they're not looking at it correctly. Mike's right. This is public policy. What we want to do is discourage people from smoking because it costs, both in terms of lives and in terms of expense. And we want to put more money in public health because we're still 49th out of the 50 states in our allocation. Then they say, well, why are we hit harder by COVID? Okay. That's the reason, and they won't address it, because they're completely out of ideas. They think cutting taxes and building the surplus is the only function of government. And that's going to continue as long as they have supermajorities.
Well, advocates for pregnant women actively oppose a pregnant worker legislation that is headed to the Senate floor. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Justin Hicks reports it comes after the bill passed through a committee this week.
Sally Dixon coordinates fetal infant mortality reviews for St. Joseph County. In her work, she's interviewed 60 mothers to find common root causes for the deaths of their babies. She testified pregnancy accommodations alone probably aren't a silver bullet fix for infant mortality, but it's one of several policies they think will help bring about the birth of healthy babies.
I would really love a pregnancy accommodation bill, but if an amendment cannot be added this year that requires the accommodation, I hope it doesn't pass and that next year we follow what Tennessee and 30 other states have done.
Business groups who want the bill to pass say it correctly balances business and worker rights more than other bills that would require accommodations.
John Schwannis, is it useful to pass this bill if it functionally does almost nothing?
The supporters of true reform would say no. This simply gives people who vote for it the opportunity to pat themselves on the back and say, look, we helped address this problem. We helped address infant mortality and these other challenges, and maternal mortality, which is also an issue, certainly, which is Indiana battles to an extent beyond many other states. So it gives them an out. And I think advocates would say, if you have a bill that essentially does nothing other than say, we support pregnant women in the workplace, why? And if anything, it makes it tougher, they would argue, I think, to bring true reform, because people would assume it's already done. I mean, it's almost, I don't want to compare it, say, to the hate crimes legislation, but in many cases, you have people who say Indiana's off the bad list because they passed hate crimes legislation, but you would have other people who say what Indiana passed is not hate crimes legislation. So
the big difference there is the hate crimes bill did actually do a lot of stuff. It just didn't go quite as far.
But it did takes the onus off of it. Yeah. Takes the wind out of the sails of those who wanted more significant change.
I think it was Karen Talion, but certainly somebody in the committee pointed out, you know, if we pass the bill right now, it gets the debate out there on the Senate floor. Because I think Senator Bray talks all the time about, well, we haven't talked about that issue on this side of the building, so maybe we shouldn't do it. Well, this gets the issue more talked about. Is there validity to that?
Maybe. I mean, a lot of women who I've spoken to kind of feel like it's almost a slap in the face to them. And it feels like, oh, you're telling me I'm allowed to ask my employer for accommodations? You know, we are citizens. We have freedom of speech. We can ask our employers for what we need. We don't need a law to tell us that.
You're having babies, for Christ's sake. It's way more than I'm doing at work.
So, knowing that the bill that advocates really want is just not happening, at least not this session, is there any point to this?
No. In fact, I think absolutely the opposite, because they'll say we dealt with it last session and we don't have to deal with it again. You cannot be the pro-birth party, which is what the Republican Party puts itself out as, and not protect pregnant women in the workplace. What they're asking for is reasonable accommodation. That's all. You know, in some cases, it's just you have to go to the hospital because you're about to miscarry, and we want to try to save the baby. It's inexplicable. It really is.
Is it better to just kill this thing off?
You know, sometimes it just depends on the issue. Like hate crimes, nobody wants to go revisit. No one in the majority wants to go revisit the hate crimes bill. That's one of those issues where you go, we did it last year. We're not coming back and growing out. But sometimes it's valuable in the process to establish a framework in law, to Karen Talion's point, elevate the conversation, and then expand it from there once it's in there. I think this might be one of those.
Quickly, John, would you expect this bill to just die a quiet death on the Senate before session ends?
I wouldn't be surprised to see that happen. Not at all.
Nikki?
No, they love to pass bills that don't really have any impact, so I think they'll totally.
All right.
Bills that do nothing.
Finally. Unfortunately, the Indiana University women's basketball team was eliminated in the Elite Eight this week, the farthest they've ever gone in the tournament, but that came after they knocked off number one NC State in the Sweet 16. However, there is some Indiana history on the line on the men's side. Gonzaga looks to become the first men's Division I team to go undefeated and win the tournament since the 1976 Indiana Hoosiers. So, Ann Delaney, will Gonzaga bump IU off of that superlative?
Well, unfortunately, I have them winning in my poll. And thank God it's Gonzaga instead of Kentucky or Duke or any other ones I could name. So I think if somebody has to do it, I'm glad it's Gonzaga.
Is Gonzaga going to do it?
It looks like that we could. I mean, they look like they're in the strongest position to. I think the big news in Indiana basketball this week, or you know, this might be the Hoosiers may return to an undefeated national championship season if they keep up the coaching moves they're making.
And a lot of confidence in Mike Woodson.
These transfers are coming back, so it's good news.
That'd be great.
That was a big one. Is Gonzaga going to win it all?
On paper, they look tremendous. I mean, they're on fire.
On paper and on the court.
But as an IU guy, you know. Not I hope. I'm gonna be throwing salt or whatever. I got the voodoo doll out. I got the pimp.
Really quickly, Nikki.
I called it 3 weeks ago. I'm going to stick with it.
All right. Yeah. That's Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwanis of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly of the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at WFYI.org/IWIR, or starting Monday, you can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity and on the WFYI app. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Join us next time, because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller. Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com. The opinions expressed are solely those of the panelists. Indiana Week in Review is a WFYI production in association with Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.